Do you want me to keep a...
Do you test?
No.
Log or...
Monday, April 11th, 1983, 5 p.m., hearing room A. Hearing Senate Bill 234, and Senate Bill 237.
She'll come to order. We've got two bills before us this evening. One is Senate Bill 237, which is sort of the omnibus bill. And there are copies right over on the tape over there. And that is the bill that deals with the marginal lands question and some changes in the EFU statutes. We also have Senate Bill 234. And what I'm going to do is just try to take testimony on both of them in one hearing, because essentially everything that's in 234 is also contained in 237. There are a few differences, but essentially they 234 is contained in 237, and we will be using 237 as the vehicle. That is, if in fact we decide to adopt some of the parts of 234, we'll incorporate them into 237. So I'm going to start out with Hector McPherson and Mrs. Kennedy. And what we'd like to do is have you go over 237, and I'd like to try to sort of set as a target about 6 o'clock. I don't know how long it's going to take you. And I'd like to remind the committee members of that we're going to try to get this overview done by about 6 o'clock, and then we're going to have an hour of public testimony. We are going to have this issue up again on Friday and probably next week too, so everyone will get an opportunity to testify. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Hector McPherson, a farmer from Linn County, and I think that I'll ask Lois first to introduce say a word about the material that's been handed out.
I'm Lois Kennedy from Corvallis, Oregon, for the record. You have before you, I believe, a farmland proposal explanatory comments, which we've prepared to help you further explain the contents of 237 and make it a little easier. I assume that not all of you are attorneys and may have difficulty going through technical details like I do, and might find the verbal explanation or the explanation paragraphs a little easier to follow. So we'll go through that, but Hector will lead you through one at a time.
You have the good fortune to know that none of us are attorneys, and you may be ahead on that score.
Thank you, Senator Day.
I'll start right out on Senate Bill 237, the Section 1, which is the Comprehensive Planning Coordination Area of the Statutes, and of course this is the definition section. And there really isn't anything new on page 1. You've got to turn to page 2 to find out what marginal lands are all about, because here is the where we talk about what qualifies as marginal land.
Hector, are you looking at this?
No, I'm looking at the statute itself, so you probably want to get that, and then as you come to that, why refer back to it.
I think it'll be helpful if you have both in front of you, and then we'll tell you which pages we're talking about. He's on page 2 of the bill itself now, and page 1 of the explanatory comments.
237 is in your bill books if you have them, and it's in your materials if
you
don't.
Yes, you should have.
Got it.
Good.
Okay. 237 in front of you, I hope.
It's an amended copy of 237. It should be in there with the original 237.
And we've already gotten to page 2, because that's where the new language begins. And on line 7, we talk about marginal land. And we get our definition of what marginal land is. And we say that marginal land is land outside of areas designated for both urban development or rural residential use. We don't want these two things to conflict with what we're trying to identify in comprehensive plans approved pursuant to or so-and-so. And now here's the tricky part, which was not a contributing part of a farm operation which produced $20,000 or more in gross sales in 3 of the 5 years preceding the effective date of this 1983 Act. Now I should call your attention that we've agonized over the wording that we have here, because and the word we're concerned about is the word contributing part. We thought of other words that might take care of this particular problem, but what we thought was that almost any land might contribute a little bit to a farm operation that might be measurable, which was one of the other terms we considered.
We didn't think we wanted it that small, but on the other hand, we didn't want to make it substantial. So we have left it simply a contributing part of a farm. So we can identify marginal land as land that is perhaps within a going farm operation that makes 20,000, provided is land that really hasn't been used. But we tie it back to the time of the passage of the Act so that a person couldn't say, leave their land bare for 5 years and say, well, my land is marginal land because it wasn't contributing. So we think we've locked that particular door anyway.
I'd like to call your attention also to lines 8 and 9 there on page 2 in that same section there. We're talking about a designation on in counties where plans have already been approved. We don't want this designation to be used now to slow up the process of plan approval. We think the legislature and the citizens of Oregon and LCDC are all concerned, let's get those plans approved. Let's not change the rules now, and we don't want to change any rules now. We want those plans to go in and be approved, and this marginal land definition would not come into play until there was the routine update of that plan, the review of the plan several years after the original approval.
Okay, the second part of that is also equally important. You may have, now this is an either-or test. You have to have it not be a part of the ongoing operation, but in addition, you have either located in an area of not less than 320 acres, of which at least 70% is composed of contiguous ownerships, which are 20 acres or less in size, excluding from this calculation areas designated for urban development or rural residential use. So this is the small parcelized areas that we see that might be quite significant, particularly in Western Oregon, that might be included in this particular kind of a marginal land classification. Now, the or part of this is the poor land. And here we say composed. Now, here I'm going to ask you to make a change. We did not use our 320 acres in the draft that you have before you, but we think it should be applied also in the marginal land that's marginal because it's poor land. So we're going to ask you to simply take the same language that you start off on line 12 and also precede what's on line 16. Located in an area of not less than 320 acres, of which 70% is composed of contiguous ownerships. And then we go to composed predominantly of soils rated lower than capability class 4 in the agricultural capability classification system, or your site class index producing 50 or more cubic feet of merchantable timber per acre per year. These are the two tests. Before I move on to that, on to other things, I probably better ask for questions here and see if we can clarify it any further.
Hector, the change that you're recommending in line 16, could you read that to me? You're adding the 320 acres in
we want to we want to add that, yes, to Part B as well as to Part A.
And how would Part B read?
It would read the way I read it. In other words, you'd simply precede this with located in an area of not less than 320 acres, comma, of which 70% is composed of contiguous ownerships.
In B, located in an area of not less than 320 acres, comma, composed predominantly of soils rated lower than capability class 4 and so forth.
So the contiguous ownership is not in there.
Right.
Okay. What we were trying to do in putting a size designation there is to avoid the temptation and the pressure on counties to spot zone.
How are you going to define predominantly?
Where do we see predominantly?
In line 16, composed predominantly of soils.
Well,
does that mean 30%?
If you look at a soil map, you'll find that in any area, there are a variety of soil types. And when you talk about predominantly, it means you have at least 50%. You know, it has to be more than 50%
maybe
to be predominantly.
Is that the definition for that? That's what he's asking. Is that I don't think that is a glossary definition.
Yeah.
There may be a test in statute, and I'd have to ask legislative counsel
out
if there is something different from that.
We may want to check that out.
That would be a point we'll want to come back to.
Exactly the amount.
Senator Roberts?
You referred to the language on line 8 on comprehensive plans approved pursuant to. Now, there are quite a few comprehensive plans that haven't been approved yet, aren't there?
Right.
Does this preclude, and I'm not sure about all the mechanics, would that preclude using this marginal land than in plans that hadn't been approved yet?
Right. That is our intent, that we in no way want to slow down the approval process. We don't want to give the counties one more thing that they can do or that they have to do or can do, depending what their mentality is.
My question was, if the plan has not already been approved, can't they now do it if this bill is passed? Wouldn't you?
No, we have specific language, Senator Roberts, that you'll be hearing a little bit later, which does that, right.
All right, thank you.
Please continue.
No more questions. We'll go on then to page 2A. In section 3, which is a brand-new section, this is not altering present law, where we go to the definitions of agricultural land. And the reason for this, this particular kind of a definition isn't in statute at the present time. Most of it is within the goal. In other words, this is goal language, a lot of it, but we've added to the goal language. In fact, as far as down as line 15 is a part of the goal language, but the excluding sections, which include the marginal land that we want to include, is not. So this would be new language there, permitting us to exclude marginal land from the general definitions from agricultural land.
One reason for putting goal language into the statute is simply an educational purpose. We think that oftentimes people working with land use planning look at the statutes and don't always have the goals beside them. And if this is repeated in the statute, it will just reinforce and make it easier for the planning officials to work with the material.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hurd.
As we work with this bill, this is the section that I questioned the other day when we were talking about the goals. I would appreciate it if maybe staff could arrange to have some witnesses appear that are familiar with the western and eastern Oregon soil classification system, because that really raises some questions about eastern Oregon soil.
Take care of that.
Thank you. We'll go on then to the permitted uses in marginal land, which you find at the bottom of page 2A. And starting off in 197-175, we would have intensive farm or forest operations, including but not limited.
Limited to farm use.
In accordance with, well, let's see.
Okay, that may be okay. So we go to 2 to 3.
I'm lost here on where I went from that.
Is 2B, is 2, where's the staff? Mr. Sadlow, is 2B a?
2B is a nothing, and it's been excluded from later.
Okay, all right. That was our confusion here. Okay, so we go from 2A to page 3.
Right.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, we're on page 3 with part-time farms at the top. These are, of course, permitted uses within the marginal lands, woodlots. One single family dwelling on a lot or parcel containing 20 acres or more. And this is highly significant. This is the big change from an EFU zone. One single family dwelling on every lot or parcel containing 20 acres or more.
That's a permitted use, not a conditional use. One would not have to go through the conditional use process to secure a building permit for a single family dwelling.
Then we go to one single family dwelling on a lot or parcel described in subsection 4 of this section, and that's the lot of record. And when we get to that, why, we'll go through that a little bit more. But we have liberalized the lot of record, so many more houses could be built on lots of smaller than 20 acres, provided there are a lot of record.
In the marginal lands category.
Okay, the non-residential uses authorized in the exclusive farm use zones, which would be, in other words, we allow everything that can go on in the EFU zone.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Day.
Yes.
On that, I've had several, I think this area that covers it, I'd have to refer to it, but I think some of the churches who deal in and have church farms and so forth are concerned about what you're doing in that area. If you want to comment on that, I have some amendments prepared in 234 that might address it, but I just wondered, do you not intend to allow them to continue their operations? And how?
Well, the churches, of course, were moved over to conditional use when we get over into the section that deals with EFU. At this point, all we're doing is saying that we allow everything in the marginal lands we allow in the EFU.
You're going to make it a conditional use. Then.
We do when we get over to the EFU land, so it does become, of course, a conditional use in this one as well.
Okay.
We should call attention to G, one mobile home in conjunction with an existing dwelling as a temporary use for the term of a hardship as defined by the commission, suffered by the existing resident or relative of the resident. Now, most of us thought that was already in the EFU law, because it is in most county ordinances, and most counties are functioning as if it is there. Apparently, it is not. But you may want to put it in the EFU statute, because it is in fact being practiced, I believe, by most counties, and we thought it was appropriate to put that into the marginal land language also.
Then we go on to number two there, which says that the local governments can impose more stringent density and so on restrictions if they have got a good reason to do it, essentially. In other words, we haven't limited them to the things that we've identified. We say that that local government can be more restrictive, or I guess the commission could as well. Now, here's the language which says when this thing becomes effective. The language under 3, on page 3, is the one which says that notwithstanding amendments to the goals made under section 1 of this section, local governments and so on, you've got to wait to your first plan review before you can bring in, and you can't bring it in as an individual unit. You have to bring it in as a whole thought-through type of change in your plan. And it says a local government shall first apply the amended goals in its first regular plan review and amendment process under ORS 197-640. So that clarifies the point we discussed a little earlier that Senator Roberts brought up. Turning the page, we come to the lot of record section, and there's almost an entire page which repeats the language from the present lot of record. And the thing that I need to call your attention to, it deletes two of the provisions in the current lot of record law, which makes it considerably broader. The present lot of record says that you have to have it between 1964 and 1975 to make it a lot of record. We remove that 1964 date, and so that any lot that's created any time prior to 1975 can be a lot of record in a marginal use zone. The other one we do is the present lot of record also says that you don't get it if you've taken the farm use tax status, you know, for the non-zoned land thing. We've taken that out so that even if you have gotten farm deferral type taxation, which is the common term applied to that, you still would be eligible to apply for and get a lot of record recognized in a marginal zone. Any questions on this?
Could I? Yes, sir, Robert. Would you go back to page 3, starting on line 24? I'm not too understanding of the distinction made there in that restriction. A local government shall apply the amended goals on an area-wide basis only, not through individual site-specific amendments to a plan and land use regulations.
Well, the purpose of that is so that you couldn't just pick out, say, well, John Jones has a single farm out here that he'd like to get put in marginal land, and so you transfer that one in rather than trying to make a unified approach to that particular area and deciding whether it fit the test that we have. So
we'd like to see it handled really in a legislative manner rather than a quasi-judicial. In other words, instead of having a landowner come in and say, I have property that comes under marginal lands qualifications according to the legislation, and I'd like to have that designated right now. And we're saying that it should not happen that way, that property owner needs to wait until the county is ready to look at the county as a whole and see where the marginal lands zone is going to be in that county. And then if he fits in, that's great.
You are considering, in effect, only a zone for a county and not applying it to using these criteria to apply to a specific large land holding or farm?
You could, of course, have a single holding that was 320 acres that one single holding could comply, but our thinking was that this was an area-wide thing and that there normally would be a number of land owners within that particular area that was designated as marginal land.
So that you might assume that the marginal land would be an area which included within it a number of different holdings. I guess the reason I raised the question, Mr. Chairman, was sometimes the process of looking at the total picture becomes so long and lengthy that the very legitimate needs of a particular landholder get put off for 10 years. And so while it legitimately is covered by it, you never get around to him and his very legitimate needs. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason I raised the question here as to the extent to which you have to wait for the whole doggone thing to be done before, I hate to use the term, but I think it's applicable, justice was seen by a particular landowner.
Well, that's something you may want to discuss and deal with. Our concern, our primary concern is that in no way should the approval of present pending plans be delayed. That was, I think
yeah,
that was our primary concern.
Yeah, I understand
okay.
that now.
And the second concern is that in terms of planning per se, it would be, we think it would be better if counties would do this as an overview of the county and look at it in a holistic way rather than just parcel by parcel. But you may wish to amend that to another, as you see fit. Our primary concern, I think, is that the comprehensive plans not be delayed, the present approval.
Okay, Chairman.
Thank you.
Yep, Sir Dave.
See, the one problem with that is that you're going under a approved comprehensive plan. They come in with an individual exception, of which is in violation of the comprehensive plan. They're then making a plan amendment. Under the post-acknowledgement system. And the only way you're going to deal with that is either put a shorter time frame and say, look, we expect you to come in, since you've had your plan approved, to at least address this issue on your comprehensive plan basis. We want you to address this right away. This is one issue you come in. But if you allow that piecemeal, then they're in violation of their comprehensive plan that's been acknowledged, and it becomes a plan amendment, and they're going to be before review anyway on a goal that doesn't exist until their periodic reviews are. And so I don't, that's what you're faced with around Robin.
Thank you.
Okay, we switch then on the bottom of page 4 from to the 215 area of the statutes, and from the marginal lands to the improvements in the EFU zone. And the very first one here is the section which deals with county planning and zoning and housing codes. And this is the specific section 215-185. This is remedies for unlawful structures and land use. That's the area of law we're dealing with. And of course, the first down through line 12 is old language that we're not changing. It's only when we get to line 13, and here is the place where we decided that the language that had been presented to you people was not the language of the philosophy that we had agreed upon. And
okay.
So we have a...
You have already received, I believe...
A single sheet here, which...
that has this changed language, which is for the paragraph beginning on line, going from 13 to 22. Basically what that does, it changes two words, and this was the intent that we wanted to be clear. On line 15, it changes the word dwelling to mobile home, and on line 17, it does the same thing. It changes the word dwelling to mobile home. And then, you may recall when we were looking at that temporary hardship mobile home provision in the marginal lands category, we said that it was not already in the EFU section. We want this provision to apply to both the EFU and the marginal lands, and so we need to delete part of line 18 and part of line 19. We begin the deletion on line 18 with the word under subparagraph and conclude the deletion on line 19 with the word 1983 Act. What that does is makes this action valid in both both marginal lands and EFU.
Where this goes again, please.
Page 5 on your bill, line 13. Okay, the paragraph that you have is a complete replacement of the paragraph lines 13 to 22. Basically what that does is simply changes the action, which would provide a plaintiff reasonable attorney fees and expenses if the court finds that a mobile home, not a permanent dwelling, needs to be removed or was there illegally.
I might go into the philosophy because
our
I think
our problem, just a minute here, is to try to see the change.
If you have any of these in the future, if you get them to us a little bit in advance, it'd be very helpful.
Well, it may be easier just to lay your paper down and let me give you the editing right on your bill copy.
Good.
Okay, line 15. Okay, you cross out the word dwelling and replace it with mobile home. Line 17. You cross out the word dwelling and replace it with mobile home. Line 18. Delete beginning with the word under, delete under subparagraph G of paragraph B of subsection 1 of section 3 of this 1983 Act. Delete that designation. So it says, beginning with line 17, or that a mobile home approved to relieve a temporary hardship is being used in violation.
I might go back and just touch on the philosophy that we're after here, and the fact that, and the reason that the original language didn't do what we wanted to do. There are a lot of problems with, particularly with mobile homes in EFU zones that are sited illegally for a number of reasons. And of course, the temporary hardship one tends to stay there after the temporary hardship is gone and be rented out. We have the case where the person simply moves a mobile home into an EFU zone without saying anything to anyone. He can do it overnight. And if he doesn't go in for a permit, nobody ever catches it. So we have a lot of mobile homes that are sited out there illegally. We wanted to get a little better handle on that, with the possibility that the person who knew about it out there could jog the county's mind and actually collect the attorney's fees if he has to carry it to court to get that thing taken care of. The problem we ran into is we talked about the permanent home. And we have permanent farm homes out there, and it's a very common thing now for the next door neighbor or some farmer to buy a farm unit and end up with a home, a permanent home out there that suddenly doesn't have a farmer in it, and therefore technically would become a non-farm. And as you know, we're not allowing new non-farm dwellings to be constructed, but we thought we also didn't want to have to tear down all the homes that might be in that farm zone. We thought that there is an ongoing use for a number of those homes as employee homes and oftentimes for a young farmer starting in, so that we thought it was better for them to stay there even if they were rented for a period of time to a non-farm person. So that is the philosophy we have in deleting the dwellings and simply applying this test to the mobile homes. If there are no questions, we'll go on to section 5. Section 215, 213 are the things that are permitted in an EFU zone. It's a long list, and it's gotten much longer since 10 years ago, 1973, when this was the big update that at least Fred Hurd and I remember. Anyway, here is the point we come to, that the question of what we do with public and private schools and churches, because we have taken them out of the permitted uses, outright permitted uses, and move them over into conditional uses. I can't point to a lot of abuse going on, but there is a tendency for new churches perhaps to want to establish themselves in private schools as well, out in a farm zone where they should at least go through some kind of a procedure. They shouldn't be allowed to simply plunk them down and say they're here, they're a permitted use. We think that there's good reason to have churches and even private schools in these zones, but they better go through the conditional use procedures to determine whether they're in the best location or not. So this was done, I think, by the interim committee bill, the one that we're also hearing testimony on, and we thought this was a good idea, and so we've allowed it. Going to the next page.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, Saturday.
I do want to clear, though, you don't know of too many misuses in that area from what you're saying to us. Is that correct?
That's true.
That was my statement.
Because I can foresee where there were not private schools or even a public school where they find they want to move into it, and we go through a conditional use and a lot of laborious hearing. It could be a very expensive process for what is a public purpose.
But it's our feeling that in the farm zone, that kind of new activity should really be open to public participation, which in a permitted use would not necessarily be the case. I think many counties have it as conditional use. So our preference would be that it be a conditional use, even though there is certainly that angle.
I hope you're not referring to the Rajneeshis when you discuss this particular issue. We certainly didn't.
No, I was thinking of you know, the Baptists and the Presbyterian and
right.
So forth, that they have church schools too, you know.
Yes, they do.
Absolutely.
Yes. Last I checked, the Seventh-day Adventists, and farms. And,
yeah.
Okay.
But we felt that at least sometimes churches might be built in an EFU zone that might better have been sited within the urban growth boundary. I guess that would be my defense of that particular point.
Yeah, I don't want to debate your point right here. I want to continue with your review, if you would, please.
No, let's see, we're at the top of page 7.
No, we're at page 6 yet. We need to look...
Oh, yes. Further down. Okay, what section?
Do you want to take line 14?
Oh, okay, here we are with a dwelling customarily provided in conjunction with farm use. If the dwelling is on a lot or parcel that is managed as part of a farm unit, not smaller than the minimum lot size in a farm zone, this would be an outright use for a farm home, provided the farm unit is of the size that is recognized as being the size that's needed for that kind of a farm.
This recognizes the reality that farms today are not always like they were 50 or 100 years ago, that some farmers are farming with several parcels that might make up a total of 100 or 200 acres, but I mean, it might be 10 acres here and 20 acres there and 30 or somewhere something else. And so this takes care of that provision.
This speaks specifically to those counties which have a minimum lot size. And a number of counties now do not have a minimum lot size, and they're taken care of under the conditional use section because they've already made it a conditional use process. But anyway, in those counties that have a minimum lot size, we say if the farm is of that particular size that rates being a farm unit, and those are recognized, why, then they can get it outright. Then down on line 23, we put a new type of thing, which I think is educational perhaps as much as anything, but anyway, we say that in the cases of a farm that may be so